Colonel Offord's real three.
I reckon that if these, at least one crewman, if not two, would be the standard of the normal fitter now, at least. And you would expect him, or the crew, or the officer as well, or the NCO tank commander, who after all had done it all himself before, to be in a position to whip a magneto off and retime it and anything of that nature, or do anything which he had the tools to do.
Mm.
Now, this was because, of course, they were first drivers, or hoping to be first drivers, for so long, till they became what they called a driver mechanic. So normally, your first driver, all driver mechanics. They'd been second driver for about 3 years, you know, and they're learning the drill and that sort of thing. So, and in fact, I would reckon that probably certainly every first driver you had could have been turned into a fitter tomorrow, just like that. A number of them were, of course.
Mm.
Now,
the driving at Perham Down, where did you do your routine driving training?
Driving all over the plane, you see. Perham Down was on the edge of the training area. You just motored out and straight across, you could motor 2 miles.
So you're using basically the same courses as you had done when you were at Bovington?
The same?
The same courses.
Oh, no. This is natural driving now, you see. But there are a fair number of obstacles on Salisbury Plain, you know, sort of hills and ditches and things like that.
Yes, yes. The equipment of the 5th Battalion, was it all medium tanks?
No. They just started to get the light tank, 2-man light tank, the Mark, I suppose, 1 or 2. And they were coming off production, of course, fairly slowly, I suppose, 2 or 3 a month, something like that. And their lack of light tanks was made up by the old Cardinoid carrier, which they installed the wireless set in and used it just as a light tank, just for training.
What were the views about the equipment? Did you regard the Cardinoids and the light tanks and the medium tanks as the kind of machines you needed? Were you satisfied with them?
Well, there was nothing else on offer anyway, so there's no point in wishing for the world. But as far as performance went, you could whip the old medium tank up to about 20, you see. You know, and so from that point of view, it didn't have very much power for hills and things like that. But, you know, I think to the soldier then, there was, Christ, we only had as many as possibly 2.5 tank crewmen per tank. You see, we're desperately short of people to man the tanks. And we used to go out with a man, just perhaps a commander, a driver, and perhaps one other crewman, sometimes not even that. He's on a medium tank. So that here you've got the business where as long as you could keep them tactically mobile, that was with a commander and a driver.
I didn't realise there were these shortages in crews. Well, the crew should have been what, 4? 4 or 5 in the mediums?
5. Should have been 5 on a medium, is it? Now, I think we had about 2.5 men per tank, that sort of thing. Mm. So desperately short. There was never any question, really, by and large, of exercising the gunner, because we didn't have a chap in his place, probably, you see.
Why were you so undermanned?
The strength of the army, I suppose, was just low. It was just as simple as that, you see. Now, these, of course, should have been made up in war with the reservists. But in fact, when the reservists were called up, most of them went to cavalry to boost them, of course, you know, because they didn't have the trained chaps still.
Carrying on talking about the actual machines themselves, I gather that the Cardinoid wasn't altogether highly regarded.
Was very desirable. It was the most uncomfortable thing and flat, but it was one took it that it was in lieu of a light tank. Until you had a light tank, you had that or nothing.
Hmm.
So there was no belly aching about it, you know what I mean?
How did they compare with the new light tanks which you were just beginning to get?
Well, currently?
No, not currently, then.
Oh, the Carden Lloyd.
How did the Carden Lloyd compare with the light tanks, the new light tanks you were beginning to get in this period?
Oh, well, of course, it wasn't as fast. It was much more uncomfortable and much slower across country because the bloody thing sort of flapped up and down. It didn't have the springing, you see. But, well, there it was. Mm. So what you might have a light tank section with one light tank and four Carden Lloyds, that sort of thing. So they gradually built up till I suppose in about 1936 or so, 35, we got enough light tanks to man the sections, light tank sections.
I see. The gunnery, the routine gunnery training of the battalion was still proceeding on the three-pounders and the machine guns, the Vickers machine guns you've been trained on. How much attention was given to each, I mean, relative to each other?
Well, we always fired both, even on a 30-yard range or a rifle range at Perham Down, for instance, the machine gun. You couldn't fire the three-pounder. But you had this simulator trainer, a RIPA, R-Y-P-A, roll your pitcher aft or something it stood for. This was really a light tank mock or a tank mock-up or a tank on a rocking RIPA, which you did your firing from an attachment, a 0.178 or main, an air rifle attachment on that, synchronized with the sights. So where the pellet went, your shot should have gone. So there was some an invaluable device, really, because it...
Sorry, I'm not quite clear how that worked.
Well, in an indoor miniature range, say 30 yards long, you had a light tank or a medium tank, and strapped onto the barrel was an air rifle. Now, this air rifle was synchronized with the sights of the tank. So that when you fired, the air rifle went off and it hit the target. So this gave you the training as though you were firing your major gun, your three-pounder. So you keep your hand in throughout the non-firing parts of the air.
And the tank itself was a mock-up on a rocking platform.
The tank, you could put it on a platform and rock the platform. It's a chap with a sort of, you know. Or you could have it just stationary and fire it like the light tank, just like that. Mm.
How useful do you think this was?
Oh, invaluable.
It compares with the real thing?
Oh, it taught you all the drills. You know, it made certain all the drills. Now, when I say drills, I mean the actual laying and the sight setting and everything had to be right to get the hit. Now, this was a thing which was then really could only be used for the two-pounder, for the three-pounder.
Apart from the RIPA, were there any other simulators used for gunnery training?
What you could also do, and we did do, was to take the machine gun, either have it on a stand and fire on the rifle range, or fire it from the tank on the rifle range, which we did at Perham Down, the light tank and the medium. So you did have that, but that, of course, was stationary shooting, which was probably a very good thing, which so happened. Mm. Because it was on a rifle range, you didn't have the room to move about. Mm. I think it's fair to say there was never any shortage of practice training ammunition to keep the chaps handy with these other training devices they had.
What other training devices were there apart from the RIPA?
Well, the RIPA, the pellet range, and of course the guns themselves. You see, the Vickers gun was a machine gun, which is very complicated bit of equipment, really, because it worked on a circular motion. It picked up the round and dropped it in line with the barrel and did this business. It was water cool, and therefore the barrel had a long life, which is a great advantage, but it did make a big hole through the tank. But it was a gun that, come what may, whatever stoppage you got, you could get it firing again. You could replace the parts in the lock on this, that, and the other. And a tremendous amount of training was done on this. The lock of the Vickers gun, I think it had about 15 parts, springs and things like this. And the crews were trained to sort of take them pieces, reassemble them, literally in the dark. Mm. You know, so that sort of training was a very high standard, I would say.
Last time you mentioned a circular room where you used the light beam. Where does that come in?
That came in from training the medium tank crew in, if you like, crew control, as though it was firing on an advance to contact and meeting occasional targets and things like that.
No, I'm not quite clear about that. I mean, what was the circular room? Where was it? What was it? Well, what was it used for?
The circular room was at Lulworth.
I see.
It was about 60 feet across, I suppose, and the whole of the wall were covered with landscape painting, literally painted by a chap who's still alive at Lulworth, good artist. And on that were placed targets. Now, in the center of this room was a medium tank mounted on a riper that could be oscillated. And you had a light connection, exactly the same idea as the 2-2 rifle, which was synchronized with the sights. Now, as this thing was oscillated, the driver could take his part, engage gears, and so on.
When you say oscillate, you mean just spin on its platform or something?
Oh, no, up and down as well.
So it would do swing. Both?
It could do both, oh yes. Because that's the roll your pitcher bar thing. It's either the pitching or the sort of... and so in this thing, you could get the impression that you were a tank crew moving in a tank, and there you saw the targets coming up by lights on this wall, and you swung the gun on to engage them.
Mm. Now, did that simulator have a different purpose than the pellet range? Or was it basically...
Oh, this was primarily for the commander, teaching him to give fire orders to the crew whereby they could pick up a target and engage it. Ah. As opposed to the 2-2 range, the pellet range, which was entirely gunner training.
I understand.
This was training the crew as a whole.
Mm. That's clear. What I'm still not quite clear about is what elements of your gunnery training did you carry out at Perham Down with the battalion, and what elements did you have to go to Lulworth for?
You carry out everything at Perham Down other than two-pounder shooting and firing the machine gun, or the two-pounder for that matter, from the move on a tank.
No. There are obviously two aspects to gunnery. One is training the gunner, and the other one is training the crew for gunnery. Have we dealt with all of the exercises involved in the training for both from both points of view?
Yes, except the fact, you see, that we talked about the riper in the what people might think of as a dome trainer, the same sort of thing they had for anti-aircraft, you know, with a bloody great dome. So that indoor trainer on the riper with the landscape target, that was the preliminary to the battle practice, where the crew were in and they gauged targets while they were moving on a course or in a certain direction, which was the final stage of training, the battle practice, prior to battle, if you like.
And that also was at Lulworth?
That also was at Lulworth.
I see. Now, just to finish with the gunnery, really, am I right in assuming that the sort of
contemporary gunnery philosophy remain that which you've been taught at Bovington as a recruit, that is, firing on the move?
Yes, other than for light tanks. There, you didn't have a starting price for the light tank because the oscillations is such a short track base on the ground that it used to pitch so much that you wouldn't have had a hope in hell.
Like to kill more of your friends than your enemies.
Yes,
I see.
Well, one aspect of gunnery and the training of plants is for it. Brings in the name of Lakeman. This fellow, Captain Tom Lakeman, a World War I gunner who transferred to the regiment in 1923, was an inventive genius. And he did more than anybody to invent all these devices like the riper, the pellet, pellet appliances, and the indoor ranges than anybody else.
I wanted to ask you a few questions about tank communications.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, communications within the tank. What methods were available at this time for communication inside the tank?
Nothing official at all. Now, the medium tank is a fairly large thing, and it's very difficult to communicate to the driver because of the distance from the top of the turret, whereas a thing like a light tank is comparatively easy, or it's easier. So I personally had a thing like a piece of hose pipe which ran down to the driver and a funnel at my end, and I simply spoke into it and he got the message. I have heard of chats, but they never really worked permanently, of getting some sort of microphone device. But it's very difficult because there's no issue of earphones or anything like that. So you had to go to something, either the hose pipe, which was pretty tricky when the turret started to rotate, or passing it through the loader, who was that side below you.
How would you pass it through? Just shout at him.
Kick him, tell him.
Yeah.
Or you'll have to get right down and bellow out, right. Either right, left, maybe right.
That's pretty crude stuff.
Very crude.
Yeah. There were about this time, I think, experiments with things like laryngophones, weren't there? Did you come
This was earlier they had laryngophones, and they were dispensed with.
What were they, and what was wrong with them?
I don't know, because the Russians still use them. I imagine in possibly something like finance or something like that. But of course, when the new range of tanks came in starting to come in 1937, say, then they did have like a tannoy system for communication.
You must have found this a very substantial handicap.
From the point of view of being able to react speedily to a changing situation, this lack of communication within the tank must have been a real problem.
Quite a problem, yeah. Now, the old hose pipe business was helped a bit because you probably didn't have a gunner anyway, so you couldn't whittle the gun in training, you see. So it didn't catch up with the hose pipe. But, oh yes, it was. One got over it, Christ knows how, but one did. And of course, anyway, it's not as though you have to give the driver, particularly a good driver, every single order. You give him a general direction, tell him to park under that hill or below that tree or something like that. And but you see, while this was going on as well, as a section commander, you had to control the rest of your section. And in my case, once it was seven tanks they gave me.
Well, this really leads us into the second question I was going to ask. That is, what means were available at this time for communications between tanks as opposed to inside?
Lastly, the radio. But then, of course, if you use radio for much communication, depending so much on how many tanks there were in the squadron, or the company as it was then. Because you see, I've been in a squadron where I've had a medium section of 5 tanks, and even 7 tanks, which they tried out in about 1936, I think, or 7. Well, now, that was your hitting power in the squadron. You only had the recce troop, or the recce section, say 5 tanks, and they might have only had 1 wireless set. So there was more access on the air, possibly, than there would be if they'd all had wireless sets. You see, particularly when they had the Carden Lloyds. But the prime method was a semaphore arm, which you put up the top of the tank, which had a signal for either line ahead or line or trident. Or you had the double flag system. Now these were a whole quiver of about 6 coloured flags. And you put them up, one above the other, and flew them. And they gave different formations and things like that. You had a card, or you knew the signals, and that gave them.
Can you remember which permutations represented which particular order?
I can't.
It's all very nautical, isn't it?
Very nautical, yes. Oh, yes. And very cumbersome. And, of course, in fact, so many of these things you could, in fact, do simply by shaking a bloody fist at somebody, you know, and he kept his eye on you. If he saw you, he knew that he was erring, and or you could wave him off or wave him back or point and that sort of thing. But it was very rudimentary.
Did you use loud hailers at all?
Only between, I used them only when I was rail linked to Justice Tilley, the Sierra the Fifth, between my rail link tank and him. That was when we'd draw up alongside and I'd come up on the megaphone, not a loud hail, just a megaphone, and bellow the new instructions or orders or whatever.
When you say just a megaphone, what do you mean exactly?
Just a piece of tin.
Yeah.
No power like they have now, you know, no amplification.
Yeah. These were very much the early days of wireless. What sort of problems did you have with them? And how did the crews take to them? Were they popular?
What, to the wireless?
Yes.
Oh, duck to water. I think they were such an advance for flexibility and control and that sort of thing that anything was better than nothing. And after all, you only knew that, you only knew the radio sets that you had. You didn't know what was possible in the future.
Yeah. I remember reading in Little Heart's History of the Tank Regiment that it was said that Hobart, who was very keen on wireless, had a lot of trouble in getting tank crews to use them, and he had to really be quite severe in...
I doubt whether this was true. I think the only trouble Hobo had was the fact that he decided that every officer should learn the Morse code. Well, this was it. Your operator could send Morse. And he started insisting that every officer learn Morse, and we started. But after about half a training season, it died out because it didn't really have much practical application. At the times, it would have been useful.
Mm-hmm. Of the standard members of the crew, which one was responsible for operating the wireless?
The loader.
I see. The annual training exercises then on Salisbury Plain with the other tank battalions, obviously, probably the major event of the year for you. Was there any general pattern about them, or were they all very varied?
Yes, they were varied because the pattern, now one must emphasise that this bloody fellow Hobo had a complete grip of the situation. And what he was doing, after all, was starting something, a new idea, a new formation, literally from scratch, and building that up, presumably, over a certain period, a number of years, no doubt. So, the theme of his training was that it was progressive, really, from one exercise to the next, one year to the next. And this included everything from the resupply with the echelons and things like that, as well as the actual control of the brigade in battle.
At the beginning of each of these exercises, was it customary for you to be given a sort of pre-exercise brief so you knew what the... How was that done?
Normally, before a brigade exercise, Hobo would summon the whole tank brigade down to the last cook's mate in one of the valleys on Salisbury Plain and would harangue them over the public address. And he would tell them, A, what went wrong on the exercise before. The nonsense were made, how they could be corrected and so on. He'd then go on to the next exercise. And he'd then explain exactly what he was doing this exercise for and what he was trying to get out of it.
Mm-hmm. And do you remember any of those briefings, the kind of objects he said were...
I don't remember the detail now, but this happened after every one. And the result of this, of course, was that every single member of the brigade reckoned he was a founder member and had a personal interest in seeing the thing went like a bomb. Mm.
Well, tell me a bit about the nature of the exercises you were involved in between 33 and 36 from the point of view of your range of operations and the goals you were given.
The range of operations, to me, seemed extraordinary as I motor up the Blandford Road and see all that agricultural land. In those days, it was all rough grassland, downland, if you like, and so it went the whole way. So, in fact, there never seemed to be any business about getting permission to go anywhere. One didn't go across crops if ever you met them, but someone so rarely did. There's no question about fussing about going on any road or having clearance or lane or anything else. It appeared to me to be a free-for-all. And we would go across country from somewhere like Bovington, Cranbourne Chase onto the plain. Literally, it appeared to me to be a free-for-all. One was never obstructed by anything like crops or anything like that, because I suppose the country was in those days so different what it is now, that one had pretty well a free rein. Mm. And the distances we would cover in a one brigade exercise, it might involve one tank battalion as the enemy against another, or I suppose it'd be anything up to 100 miles or more. Mm.
And what were the themes of the exercises you were involved in?
Well, the themes would be something like seizing a particular objective, ground vital to the enemy, well behind the line, we'll say, a ledge line, or rapid advance to occupy a position to the detriment of the enemy. An actual attack, of course, against enemy formations.
And in these exercises, were they purely tank brigade exercises, or were you involved did other arms of the army get involved in them?
Most of them were simply tank brigade exercises. And I'm sure this was because there were no other arms that were in a position to take part, because they're either horse-drawn or foot, normally infantry formations with horse transport and things like that. So it's inconceivable they could have been involved if they couldn't keep up with the pace that Hobo was demanding from the tank brigade. Mm. So it's difficult to see how they could have been into it. And, it's always been a when I hear people say that Hobo didn't believe in other arms and things like this, I don't believe this is so. I think it's merely he was trying to show what a tank brigade could do. Now, make other arms as mobile, and they could do that much better. Mm. I think this was really his theme, and this is borne out by later on in the war, when we, on an exercise, I think it was Bumper or something, about 1940, end of 41 or something like that, and I was parked in my